This is tape number two on St. Thomas Aquinas.
Thomas's proof for the existence of God contains within itself only a minimal indication of him. The proof is not much in comparison with the divine reality itself, but in Thomas's mind that little goes quite a long way. He tells us that even though we can know that God exists, we don't and can't know just what he is. The best we can do is cultivate the precious hints implied in the proof. But we must remember that all names, even positive ones, identify God only by setting him apart from creatures. Names said of God do not give us the kind of knowledge that we normally obtain about things. In an earlier work, Thomas had written,
"The chief way to consider the divine essence is by way of negation. For by its immensity, the divine essence transcends every form attained by our intellect. And so, in apprehending it, we do not know what it is. But by knowing what it is not, we get some knowledge of it. And the more things we are able to deny of it, the nearer we come to knowing it."
In the Summa, Thomas speaks of this negation as knowledge by removal or remotion.
Once we know that a thing exists, there remains the further question of the manner in which it exists. Now, because we cannot know what God is, but rather what he is not, we have no means for considering how God exists. It can be shown how God is not by removing from him whatever is not fitting, and these are composition, motion, and the like.
Thomas starts out to show that God is simple. He disputes the idea that he is complex in any way. We can see this by continuing to compare God to creatures. Every creature has potentiality or passivity in its makeup because that's the nature of any compound. Consider, if in forming a compound, two actual substances were to preserve their own identity, then they would remain two substances. No new single composite would result. Hydrogen would still be hydrogen and oxygen would be oxygen, but they could not combine to become H2O or water, which has very different properties. So every composition has passivity or potentiality in its makeup, whereas God does not. One part of a composite may be an active component, while the other is a more passive component. For example, heat may be the active element in water, and electric current can be active in a metal wire. But the separate components of a compound have the potential to combine into an actual new unity, as malt and water unite to form beer. Each component surrenders the independence that it enjoyed in its pure state. Thomas examines many kinds of compositions and concludes that God is not made according to any of them.
The absolute simplicity of God may be shown in many ways, for there is neither composition of quantitative parts in God, since he is not a body, nor composition of form and matter, nor does his nature differ from his subsistence, nor his essence from his being. Neither is there in him composition of genus and difference, nor of subject and accident. Therefore, it is clear that God is in no way composite, but is altogether simple.
God has no potential to change or combine. The unmoved mover, the uncaused cause, is pure actuality. Thomas remarks,
"It has already been shown that there is some first being whom we call God, and that this first being must be pure act, without the admixture of any potentiality. God is infinite, comprehending in himself all the plenitude of the perfection of all being."
It's important to recognize that Thomas's conclusion is not a generalization arrived at by counting and inspecting every kind of combination. To make his point, he doesn't need to mention every possible composition. His argument holds for anything and everything that has any passivity or potentiality in it at all. Every creature has its own essence and its existence as a fundamental part of its composition. And every creature is contingent, that is, its existence depends on many other things. Thomas says a creature can be what it is only by receiving its existence and essence from the cause of being. Now, God is not made according to any mode of composition, not even any composition of essence and existence. In the first place, God's not made at all. God's very essence is to exist. He exists by his very nature. God is ultimately distinguished from all other creatures because God is being, but creatures only have being. And creatures have their being only as long as God communicates it to them. In a number of articles in the Summa Theologiae, similar arguments are advanced to show that this purely actual, simple God is perfect, good, infinite, omnipresent, changeless, eternal, and unique. In this long argumentation, Thomas begins to make explicit the deepest meaning of his key term, which translates as act or actuality. In doing so, he takes a step beyond his mentor Aristotle. Thomas tells us that the primary meaning of act is not form or substance. Act is the very act of being. Act is existence itself.
Being is what is most perfect in everything, because it is related to everything else as act. For nothing is actual, except inasmuch as it exists. And so it is that being itself is the actuality of all things.
And again, he says,
the act of being is that which is most intimate in each and every thing, and what is deepest in them all, since it is formal and decisive in relation to everything else that goes to make up a thing.
It's not surprising, then, that Thomas finds the most fitting name for God to be the very name that God has given himself, a name that human reason recognizes as the supreme name. Following the Latin understanding of a biblical text, Thomas renders the divine name revealed to Moses as He Who Is. In this scriptural expression, Thomas finds theological confirmation of what his philosophy also tells him. God is pure being, or pure act. God is the subsistent being itself. This is a high point for Thomas, since this active sense of being lights up all he has to say about God and creatures. Its importance is shown by the unusually personal way in which Thomas introduces this sense of being in his disputed question on the power of God. In arguing his own position in the Summa and elsewhere, Thomas invariably begins his response with the stock scholastic formula in the impersonal third person. In reply, it must be said. Very rarely does he speak in the first person. But something of the excitement of his insight shows through in the way he draws our attention to the ultimate principle on which everything else depends.
This act of being that I am talking about is the most perfect of all things. And this is obvious from the fact that act is always more perfect than potency. What I call the act of being is the actuality of all acts, and for this reason is the perfection of all perfections. Nothing can be added to the act of being that is extraneous to it, since nothing is extraneous to it except nothing.
This name, pure subsistent act of being, distinguishes God from creatures in the most absolute way. At the same time, God's name is the most positive and actual of all names, and so Thomas also calls this name the name by way of excellence or supereminence. This name enables us to speak further about God. Since God causes creatures to be, Thomas reasons that some remote likeness of their cause must reside in them. And so we can sort through the various names and the perfections they signify to find some few that will permit us to speak fittingly, though still inadequately, about God. We know already that we can only use names that signify qualities that can be infinitely expanded and elevated. Thus, for example, we can say that God is good and wise because we can't have too much goodness or wisdom. God possesses infinitely expandable qualities in a manner that transcends earthly realities. Yet Thomas says that God is not an impersonal being. Rather, he possesses a supreme intelligence and will, and that he is knowingly and lovingly concerned with his creatures. Thomas puts it,
God necessarily knows things other than himself, for it is manifest that he perfectly understands himself, Otherwise, his being would not be perfect, since his being is his act of understanding. Now, if anything is perfectly known, it follows of necessity that its power is perfectly known. But the power of anything can be perfectly known only by knowing to what that power extends. Since, therefore, the divine power extends to other things by the very fact that it is the first effective cause of all things, God must necessarily know things other than himself.
What's more, God not only knows, he loves.
God loves all existing things. For all existing things, insofar as they exist, are good, since the being of a thing is itself a good, as is likewise whatever perfection it possesses. Now, God's will is the cause of all things. It must needs be, therefore, that a thing has some being and some kind of good, only inasmuch as it is willed by God. Hence, since to love anything is nothing else than to will good to that thing, it is manifest that God loves everything that exists, yet not as we love.
As the treatise on God unfolds still further, Thomas moves on into properly theological territory. He inquires into the Trinitarian nature of the divine life. This subject is not the business of the philosopher, yet the treatise bears reading because it thoughtfully reinterprets some accepted philosophical notions. The triune God, so to speak, bursts the ordinary meaning of unity because of the abundance of being and life that's contained within the Godhead. The mysterious and sacred fusion of unity and multiplicity in the one God is as much like a family of individuals as it's like one individual. Yet the triune God is utterly unlike both. In his analysis, Thomas stretches the boundaries of standard categories like unity and simplicity, sameness and difference, relation and personhood. The philosopher, in principle, can't follow Thomas the theologian into that realm of religious and spiritual revelation. He may not even want to. Nevertheless, the explosion of ordinary meanings caused by the revelation can give a philosopher pause. It can return him to more familiar paths with a new wariness about accepting the obvious. In the unity of the divine nature, the ordinary notion of relation as a connection between two or more things gives way to a transcendental notion that relations can be people charged with absolute independent reality. With considerable understatement, Thomas remarks,
"A difficulty seems to arise from the fact that while the divine persons are multiplied, the essence nevertheless retains its unity."
Perhaps the most accurate meaning of Thomas's observation is that some theologians believe divine relations to be external connections between independent divine persons as they are, in a way, between human persons. Thomas continues,
"In the relations, they thus considered only the idea of reference to another, and not the relations as realities in themselves. In creatures, relations are accidental, whereas in God, they are the divine essence itself."
As he turns to his treatise on creation, Thomas considers how creatures proceed from God. The causal relation between creatures and God is ever on his mind. He says that God's causation, looked at from the point of view of a creature, is the creature's participation. For as Thomas's proof of God intends to show, the creature receives its very being by participating in God's continuing presence. Knowingly or not, the creature exists in the presence of God. The participant, then, is not a moment in a time sequence or a link in a chain of causes. The participant is precisely a creature, a partner in a simultaneous vertical causation. In this unique communication, there's a continuing influx of being from the Creator, an influx that constitutes the whole and entire creature in its actual existence. And also, in this unique participation, a creature receives its own essence and its existence.
That God gives being to a creature depends on God's will. Nor does he conserve things in being otherwise than by continually giving being to them.
Thomas asks whether the perfections of all things are in God. He replies that they are, but in a very different and higher way. The arguments against Thomas's position find their force in opposing attitudes about simplicity and complexity. Some objectors believe simplicity has an empty meaning, as with an empty cupboard that has no contents and is devoid of internal differences. These objectors set the simplicity of God against the multitude of determinations found in things.
It seems that the perfections of all things are not in God, for God is simple, whereas the perfections of things are many and diverse. Therefore, the perfections of all things are not in God.
Make up your mind, these objectors seem to say. God is either simple and therefore indeterminate, or he is filled with determinate content and therefore not simple. In a word, he is either simple or perfect, but not both. Another objector voices the difficulty literally.
Opposites cannot coexist. Now, the perfections of things are opposed to each other, for each species is perfected by its own specific difference. Therefore, because opposites cannot coexist in the same subject, it seems that the perfections of all things are not in God.
If a thing is green, then it's not some other color, and it can't be both simultaneously. Or again, if a thing is a lion, then it's not a lamb. And in general, if a being contained all perfections, it would be at war with itself. Therefore, to attempt to maintain simplicity and fullness in one and the same being is contradictory. The objector voices the ancient conundrum of the one and the many as it comes to a head in the divine nature. To resolve the impasse, Thomas compares the manner in which perfection exists in a cause and also in an effect. He says,
"Whatever perfection exists in an effect must be found in the producing cause, either in the same way as when man reproduces man, or in a higher degree. Thus, the likeness of whatever is generated by the sun's power is in the sun. Now, it is plain that the effect pre-exists in the power of the agent in a more perfect way. Since, therefore, God is the first producing cause of things, the perfections of all things must pre-exist in God in a higher way."
If a cause belongs to the same order as an effect, as do, for example, the human parent and the human child, then the specific perfection exists in both in the same basic way. In this example, both parent and child have the capacity for being human, though they will differ as individuals. Thomas calls this a univocal likeness. But what if a perfection communicates to a receiver across these lines of resemblance? For example, the sun causes many effects that don't resemble the fiery ball in the heavens. It surely causes plants to grow and enables people to see. If we can speak here of a likeness at all between the cause and its effects, the similarity is not within the same order. Thomas calls this an equivocal or analogous likeness. He frequently speaks of the likeness that holds between cause and effect.
"In every agent, that is properly called power by which the agent acts. Now, everything that produces something by its action produces something like itself."
If we're to understand this maxim, however, we must abandon any notion of a physical resemblance. The likeness spoken of is not necessarily proportional, as in a scale model. It doesn't resemble someone as a photograph does. It's not a formal likeness at all. It's a likeness of presence. Let's consider the opposite case. If we blot out the sun, in its absence, the green leaves will pale. Growth will stop and decay will begin. There's no formal resemblance between sun and chlorophyll or between sun and increasing plant size, but there is a real relation of presence. In this example, the presence is the solar energy which transforms the plant and which itself is transformed in the plant. So too is existence received and transformed in the creature. The primary and ultimate presence, Thomas argues, is the act of being. God, as first cause, communicates to us this presence of being. This presence of being is not a merely psychological presence. It's not an idea in a mind, nor a cosmological presence, that is, a presence of a thing in nature. The presence of being is an ontological presence. The actuality of being stands prior to all else in every being. Without it, there is total absence. The presence of being is communicated from God to us, from the cause to the effect. Such a presence already exists in God in a higher, more eminent, and active manner. Now, Thomas asks, what is the precise way in which God may be said to contain the perfection of the things he creates? He replies that God is the supreme agent who makes things be. In this sense, then, all the perfection of things pre-exist in God in the most perfect way, not as they are in themselves, but as they are in God's power to give them being. In his treatise on creation, Thomas begins with this question-like proposition. Whether it's necessary that every being be created by God? The proposition is followed by several objections. The first of them has relevance for us today. The objector throws out this challenge.
It would seem that it is not necessary that every being be created by God. For there is nothing to prevent a thing from being without that which does not belong to its essence, as someone can be human without being white. But the relation of the thing caused to its cause does not appear to be of the very essence of beings, for some beings can be understood without that relation. Therefore, they can exist without it, and hence it is possible that some beings should not be created by God.
The objection argues that in order to know about things, we don't need to know about God and his creative causality. All we need to know are the things themselves. This objection says that instead of opening knowledge up to an infinite and mysterious ocean of substance, we can keep knowledge within the formal boundaries of things and avoid their deeper ontological roots, if they do in fact have any. We've already seen this cast of mind, which in our day has taken the name of positivism. In reply, Thomas concedes that at a certain level we can know things on their own terms. He agrees we can arrive at suitable descriptions or definitions of all things, but this knowledge is incomplete, he says, since what a thing is involves the cause of its being just as much as it involves its definition and properties. So to completely know things, we must inquire into their deepest origin.
It must be said that everything that in any way is from God. For whatever is found in anything by participation must be caused in it by that to which it belongs essentially. God is self-subsisting being itself, and subsisting being can be only one. Therefore, all beings other than God are not their own being, but are beings by participation. What is greatest in being and greatest in truth is the cause of every being and of every truth.
Having concluded that every being must be caused by God, we may be surprised to find the next article asking whether primary matter is created by God. Surely Thomas has already answered this in the previous topic, but a little thinking shows that this is not so. Every created being is, for Thomas, a composite. But primary matter is pure and unformed. Primary matter is the potentiality to form, and so it's a simple component of certain kinds of composites. Primary matter is not itself a composite. Now, some philosophers have held that unformed matter has existed throughout eternity. It's the pure potentiality used by God in forming things. This is similar to the modern view that the world about us has emerged from a chaotic swirl of atomic matter that's existed forever. We've already seen Thomas's position regarding the eternity of the world, but what is strictly at issue is not whether the world is eternal, but whether there is anything that is uncreated other than God. Prime matter isn't much, it isn't actual, it's merely potential. Yet that's too much for Thomas. For him, absolutely nothing is independent of God's creative power. For his dialogue on creation, the objectors have other arrows in their quivers. One emphasizes the differences between gods and creatures. The objector puts the case.
It would seem that primary matter is not created by God, for whatever is made is composed of a subject and of something else. But primary matter has no subject. Therefore, primary matter cannot have been made by God.
Thomas concedes that when we consider the familiar changes around us, we think of an existing object that then undergoes change. Indeed, Aristotle had even described a pre-existing substrate that undergoes change. But when we speak of creation, we speak of a kind of coming into being that has no preceding state. Creation does not presuppose an existing subject waiting in the wings to receive being. Before a being is created, it's nothing at all. Indeed, it's not too much to say that before the world was created, whether from eternity or not, it was not possible for the world to be. A second objector still denies that matter is made by God, borrowing Thomas's own characterization of God as pure act.
Activity and passivity are opposite members of a division. But just as the first active principle is God, so the first passive principle is matter. Therefore, God and primary matter are two principles divided against each other, neither of which is derived from the other.
And so the objector protests that something does escape God's creative power and will. Here we come to the crucial issue. In his solution, Thomas takes us through a brief lesson in the history of philosophy. It's drawn mostly from Aristotle's metaphysics, but it goes beyond that great philosopher. As he looks back over the progress of philosophy, Thomas identifies three major stages in the philosopher's struggle to know the truth about things. What's at issue is the nature of being and what it means to come to be. In philosophy's first stage, which corresponds to the Greek philosophers before Plato and Aristotle, Thomas notes that the materialists were dominant.
At first, being rather undeveloped, they failed to realize that any beings existed other than sensible bodies.
Some early philosophers, like Parmenides, had denied that any being comes to be. Being is being, and that's that. Others, such as Heraclitus and Empedocles, had admitted that things come into being, but they'd pictured movement and becoming in purely physical terms. Following Aristotle, Thomas recapitulates the development of early thought.
The ancient philosophers gradually, and as it were, step by step, advanced in the knowledge of truth. At first, being rather undeveloped, they failed to realize that any beings existed except sensible bodies. And those among them who admitted movement did not consider it except according to certain accidents. For instance, according to rarefaction and condensation.
All of these early philosophers supposed the universe to be an uncreated material substance which takes on different shapes and qualities. And they believed that only physical forces altered that universe. A second stage of philosophical thinking was reached by Plato and Aristotle. Plato's theory of ideas or forms became the basis for the way things are. Each thing comes to be by participating in one or more forms. Being was no longer identified with what is material and sensible, but with various kinds of things. To the question, what is it for a thing to be? Plato and Aristotle answered, it's to be a certain kind of thing. It's to be an instance of one or another type. To come to know things, we need to classify them according to what they are. In Thomas's words,
an advance was made when Plato and Aristotle understood that there was a distinction between the substantial form, which determines what the thing is, and matter, which constricts the form to an individual. They held matter to be uncreated, and they posited certain universal causes for the change in things.
These first two stages of philosophy prepared the way for the third. Looking back to the first two stages, Thomas finds that they've kept being under wraps. The way they considered being was too restricted. Philosophers in the first stage saw being as this or that state of affairs, hot or cold, large or small. Philosophers in the second stage saw being as this or that specific sort of thing, animal, vegetal, inorganic, and other such classifications.
Each of these opinions, therefore, considered being under some specific or particular aspect, namely, either as this thing of a certain sort, or as a thing in one condition or another. And so, too, they assigned particular causes to the production of things.
Thomas believes his own work is the third stage of philosophical development. He puts forward what is, in truth, his own position with the modest words, "Then others advanced further." Thomas develops certain suggestions that he finds in the work of some Arabic and Jewish philosophers, such as Avicenna and Moses Maimonides. Of course, he's certainly aware of the biblical texts on creation and of the early Christian notion that creation was ex nihilo, out of nothing. But he ratifies this insight with a proper philosophical expression.
Others advanced further and raised themselves to the consideration of being as being. And they assigned a cause to things, not only according as they are things of this or that kind, or things in this or that condition, but according as they are beings.
At last, coming to be has itself come to be. Or rather, being and coming to be have been recognized at this third stage of philosophy. The cause of becoming has been proportionate to the understanding of reality at each stage. In the third stage, Thomas recognizes being in its absolute character. It's no longer under material and formal wraps. He can now say why we come to be, not in terms of material conditions or formal archetypes, but in terms of being itself. He continues,
"Therefore, whatever is the cause of things considered as beings must be the cause of things, not only according as they are made particular by accidental forms, nor according as they are made to be this or that sort of thing by substantial forms, but also according to all that belongs to their being, in any way whatever."
Since prime matter is a component of material things, it too must be created as part of the things themselves, and it must be created by the pure being who causes all being, and whose proper effect is the being of things. This view remains true if the world has always existed, and it remains true if, as the Christian faith holds, it has not. After describing his view of creation, Thomas passes on to what he calls the Treatise on Angels. This treatise earned him the nickname the Angelic Doctor. No one had ever written so extensively and so clearly about pure spirits and first creatures. The concept of angels is another matter beyond the boundaries of philosophy, so we pass it by. But we should note how densely populated the universe is, at least as Thomas sees it. Between man and God, there are countless hierarchies of angelic beings giving glory to God. There are also the angels' dark counterparts, what the Bible calls principalities and powers, which work against God's intention. In his work on creation, Thomas takes up certain theological questions regarding the work of the six biblical days of creation. After this short section comes his treatise on man, which was to have an important and enduring influence in philosophical history. Before we turn to the treatise on man, though, we should mention Thomas's notion of image. That's a distinctive relation that serves as the bridge between man and God. And this notion of image plays an important role in his thoughts on providence or divine government. Thomas examines the scriptural adage that human beings are made in the image of God. This confirms his philosophical reasoning because it follows from the philosophical conclusion that God is the cause of man. This idea also follows from the philosophical maxim that every cause produces a likeness in the effect, even though we've learned that the likeness may be a very remote one. Thomas asks whether the image of God is in man. His answer qualifies the ordinary meaning of the word image.
It is clear that the notion of likeness is essential to the notion of image, and that an image adds something to likeness, namely that it is copied from something else. For an image is so called because it is produced as an imitation of something else. And so an egg, however much like and equal to another egg, is not called an image of the other egg because it is not copied from it. But equality does not belong to the essence of an image, as we see in a person's image reflected in a glass. Yet equality is of the essence of a perfect image, for in a perfect image nothing is wanting that is to be found in that of which it is a copy. Now, it is manifest that in man there is some likeness to God, copied from God as from an exemplar. Yet this likeness is not one of equality, for such an exemplar infinitely excels its copy. Therefore, there is in man a likeness of God, not indeed a perfect likeness, but imperfect. And Scripture signifies the same thing when it says that man was made to God's likeness. For the preposition to signifies a certain approach, as of something at a distance.
Thomas further refines this concept of image in the next article, noting three different ways that a thing can be like God.
Some things are like God, first and most commonly, because they exist. Secondly, because they live. And thirdly, because they know or understand. These last, as Augustine says, approach so near to God in likeness that among all creatures, nothing comes nearer to him.
In his prologue to the second part of the Summa, Thomas tells us that God's image in man consists in man's free will.
Each person has understanding, free will, and command of himself. Following upon what has been said about God, who is the exemplar or model, and what has been said about the created things, which have come about through the free use of the divine power, it remains to consider God's image, that is to say, the human being, insofar as he is himself the source of his acts, having free will and power over his own actions.
We realize ourselves as persons, above all through appropriate activity. As we work and live with the actuality that is God, we become more God-like. At the same time, we define and shape ourselves.
What is particular and individual is found in a special and more complete way in rational substances, for they have dominion over their own actions. They are not only acted upon, as are other substances, but they act out of themselves. Now, it is proper to individuals to act. And so, among the various substances, a special name is given to individuals who possess a rational nature, and this name is person.
As Thomas turns to the nature of man, the angelic doctor knows full well that a human being is not an angel. Still, he believes the human soul is not merely a visitor to this planet. On the contrary, the soul is intimately present everywhere in the body as its home. More precisely, Thomas believes the body is taken up into the soul. By Thomas's time, the 13th century, Christians had drawn inspiration for over 1,000 years from Plato's teaching about the human soul. In grasping the soul's spiritual character, Plato had seemed almost to make it a sort of visitor, residing for a time in the body. Like the philosopher who returns to the cave in Plato's famous metaphor, the soul enters the body to arrange things for the body's good. After this long tradition of Platonism, perhaps nothing disturbed 13th century Christians more than the new ideas spawned by Aristotle's rediscovered works. The most upsetting idea of all was the way Aristotle bound the human soul so closely to the body. This seemed to threaten the cherished Christian concept of the immortal separate soul. Indeed, Aristotle's ambiguous views in this vital question of the soul had created controversy among his Latin followers. Some philosophers claimed that Aristotle had denied the possibility that the human soul is immortal, and they embraced this view. Others broke with this interpretation, preferring the more independent and freewheeling Platonic soul. Thomas clearly accepts the general lines of Aristotle's teaching on the human soul. He insists that the soul benefits from its relation with the body, since only in the body can the soul realize its proper function. Thomas is determined to defend the integrity of the individual human being, body and all. The Platonists exaggerated the spiritual element in man, whereas the Latin followers of some Arabic philosophers subordinated the individual to a collective intelligence. Thomas disagrees with both.
If anyone say that the intellectual soul is not the form of the body, he must explain how it is that this action of understanding is the action of this particular man. For each one is conscious that it is he himself who understands. It is one and the same man who is conscious both that he understands and that he senses. But one cannot sense without a body, and therefore the body must be some part of man.
Thomas says that only with soul and body can the human being fully exercise his natural powers of nutrition, sensation, and perception, imagination and memory, emotion and desire. Only in union with the body can the soul carry out in full measure the intellectual activities of knowing and willing. But this intimate involvement of soul and body was too much for many theologians and devout Christians. even though the Christian theology of the incarnation and the resurrection emphasizes the importance of the body in human life. Thomas seems to some to veer towards a sort of materialism, a view that reduces the soul to a mere effect of the body. In this view, the soul perishes with the corruption of the body. But Thomas also may be seen as making his own way, taking a step beyond Aristotle without going back to Plato. To Thomas, neither the philosophers nor their opponents are right. The human soul is neither lost in matter nor indifferent to it. In most of its functions, the human soul exercises the primary informing role in the human composite, giving the composite its specifically human nature. But it has its own proper activity as well.
This is the end of Side 1. Please fast forward and turn over your cassette.